सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू रिटर्न टू अनदर सब्जेक्ट दैट इज एक्सट्रीमली इम्पोर्टेंट फॉर पाकिस्तान डेवलपमेंट। It is the most important subject of governance that everybody talks about. Our new Prime Minister is talking about it. The whole world is talking about our governance and our governance capacity. So today we are going to try and take that up and see how we can deal with the subject, very important subject of civil service reform. I'm very happy to say that I've got here with me Dr. Ishrat Hussain, a well-known personality, former governor of the Central Bank, former vice chancellor of the IBA, in Karachi, which is one of our best institutions in the country. But more importantly, he did that report, the National Commission for Governance Reform. He did that report in 2005 as a special advisor to the government at that time. And I think that's an important report that needs to be discussed far and wide, because we do need that governance reform, and Imran has been talking about it. So let's hope this government can do it. Dr. Ishrat may play a role in this government, but we'll wait and see. But for the moment, let's talk to Dr. Ishrat about this report and about the governance reform that he's envisaging. But before I bring him in, let me also add that he's written a book recently, which is very important. Everybody must read that book. The book has a very provocative title called Governing the Ungovernable. So we shall ask him about it too. And so we'll take up the subject of governance in Pakistan. So welcome, Dr. Ishrat.
Thank you, Nadeem.
Dr. Sir, please tell us, what is your view on governance reform, starting off from the NCGR to your current book?
I think the NCGR, which consisted of six eminent private sector individuals who were experts in their own rights, and six secretaries to the government. And there was a steering committee, which was headed by the President of Pakistan, consisted of the Prime Minister and all the four chief ministers, who were supposed to take decision every 3 months on the recommendations of the NCGR. So it was not that you compile a report after 2 years and then bring it to, but you get the feedback from the political masters as to how these reforms will fit in with their own preferences. But unfortunately, President Musharraf got distracted by the judicial crisis, the emergency, Lal Masjid, and the elections. And this momentum was lost. And we could not actually have these meetings regularly. Okay. And got the decisions which were required in order to implement these. So finally, the report was submitted to Mr. Yusuf Reza Gilani as the new Prime Minister in 2008. And despite a lot of back and forth, his answer was that we are new to this job. We are trying to grapple with too many problems. So if we restructure our civil service and our government at this stage, this will be very disruptive of our efforts. Then after their tenure, it was Mia Nawaz Sharif, who himself told me at a very small dinner that, look, I am getting very frustrated because the civil servants are not allowing me to fulfill my election manifesto. They are creating a lot of hurdles in my way. So, Dr. Sir, why don't you come to the cabinet meeting and present the findings of the report and convince the cabinet that this is the way to go ahead with our agenda of economic and social development. That day was in 2015, and since then I never heard about it. And I was told that it was not the politicians who opposed the presentation, but it was some civil servants in very key positions who felt that their entitlements of the reservations of the positions would be dislodged by the adoption of this. So I was never given an opportunity.
But Dr. Saab, let me play the devil's advocate. Some would say that this civil service has lasted us for 200 years and in some sense has been the bulwark of stability and done things right. Why would you want to change it?
Well, because till 1990, this book provides very solid evidence.
Your book, Governing the
Ungovernable. Governing the Ungovernable. That there is a positive correlation between the institutional performance and the rate of economic growth. And you as a development economist and I as a development economist consider that unless we revive growth to 7 to 8%, the 1 to 1.5 million young men and women who will be entering the labor force would be frustrated, would be disaffected, may create social, you know, tension in the country. Therefore, for us, we have to identify what is the missing element. Why we had for 40 years, despite so many shocks to the country, both economically and non-economically, we were growing at 6 and 6.5% for 40 years. Very few countries did. So my study, empirically based, came to the conclusion that the weakening and the decay of the institutions has actually led to the decline in economic growth.
And principally, you think that's a civil service?
That is a civil service, because all the institutions were headed by the civil servants.
Right.
I give you the example of PIDC, WAPDA, Agriculture Development Corporation, and PICIC. All these four institutions were headed by individuals of the civil service who were competent men of integrity and were very much passionate about them. So we got the Indus Basin works done. We got Tarbela and Mangala Dam. We had the diffusion of the high yielding varieties, which made us self-sufficient. We had no industrial base, and look at the industries which came up after the PIDC. And look at the whole issue of the PICIC, that the private sector was provided the financial means in order to undertake, and PIDC then receded in. All these four organizations, you compare them from what they were until 1990 and now, you will be shocked.
So what in your view has gone wrong? Why has the civil service stopped serving us well as compared to the
Very good question.
Past?
And my finding is that it started with 1973 civil service reforms of Mr. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, a charismatic leader who could have done a great deal for this country. But he, for some reason or other, was very much hostile to the CSP class. So the first thing he did was to abolish the civil service of Pakistan. He thought that these are Brahmins who are more powerful than the politicians and they have to be set right. He removed the constitutional security of job, which was guaranteed to us. I joined the civil service in 1964. My appointment letter says that I am given a assurance that I cannot be removed on arbitrary or discretionary matters.
Without due process.
Without due process. That security was removed in the 1973 constitutions. He merged all the civil services in 22 pay scales. Unified pay scales. Now you tell me.
Doctor, before that, how many pay scales did we have in the government?
We had lots of pay scales.
Yes. Education was different, judiciary was different, everything was different.
But you know, I still maintain that every job is different.
Yeah.
Now you cannot place the teacher of a college in the same grade as a superintendent of an office. Mm-hmm. So if you have to raise the salary of the college teacher because you have a scarcity of science teachers, you have to raise the salaries of the office superintendents, which are abundant in supply. For one office superintendent job, you can get 10,000 applications. For a chemistry teacher, you might not even get one or two applications. So the scarcity in the labor market should actually determine the compensation packages rather than a uniform. So there was a disincentive to the civil servants that they were not secure.
So the first thing is unified pay scale, second security.
Security. Mm-hmm. And third was the induction of the politically appointed lateral entrants. Mm-hmm. So each minister was given a quota that you can nominate 20 or 15 or 10 people who will become part of the...
Without any due process.
Without any due process. Okay. I mean, there was an examination, but the examination was just a perfunctory examination. Right. So this trade-off, which I personally thought was very necessary to bring in the brightest and the best talent in the country, which is security and satisfaction of job, compensation did not actually matter. So there was a trade-off between lower compensation, but job satisfaction and security. This equilibrium was also completely, you know, terminated at that time. So you have low compensation, you have no security, and you have no job satisfaction. So from 1974 onwards, the quality of the human resources, which started entering the civil service, went completely down the drain. Mm. And the people who thought that they would extract rents for themselves and for their political masters, that kind of individuals started opting. And at that time, the private sector had developed, and the private sector was able to attract the best and the brightest, and some of them went outside the country also. Mr. Zia-ul-Haq had no interest other than Islamicization of the economy. So thankfully, mercifully, he allowed Mr. Ghulam Isaa Khan, who was one of the very able and an honest civil servant, to run the administration. So throughout the 1988, we did not have the politicization of the civil service. And he carried out the jobs and manned these institutions with the first-rate civil servants who were recruited in 50s, 60s, and 70s. Come 1988, we have a situation where the incoming government brought in their own loyalists to the key positions in these institutions. 2 years later, that government is removed. A new elected government comes in. All the civil servants who belonged to the previous regime were sidelined, made OSDs, and a new group of people occupied this. So loyalty and patronage became the hallmark of career progression. And that, I think, is the start. And that is the start of the decaying of the institution.
But, Lord Sir, let me ask you another question. Let me, again, another provocative question. I mean, given that I come from Chicago, I have to put this to you, that if we reduce the size of the government to negligible terms, do we need to worry about the civil service?
No. I think you are making two distinct points. In my NCGR report, I said 85% of the annual salary bill of the government servants goes to the people who are in grade 1 to 16. And only 15% goes to the grade 17, 22. If you are able to shrink this grade 1 to 17, who are in excess supply at this moment, and reallocate that money to the 17 to 22, and open up the 17, 22 to scientists, to engineers, to accountants, to all professionals, you will be able to strengthen the civil service and the institutions by bringing in the talent, but reduce the size of the government. So those are not mutually exclusive. It is the quality of the government, which I am emphasizing, should be changed. And then you bring in e-government.
So even if we go to more market, we still need a government.
Yeah, you need the regulatory.
So just give me an idea, what do we need the government for? What should be the role of
the
government?
Three things. The ownership, policy, and regulations have to be separated. So even if you retain some institutions under the government ownership for one reason or the other, and that's a different debate altogether, you need a ministry or an agency which exercises the powers of supervision, direction, to safeguard the interests of the owners. The second is the policy making. Both the public sector and the private sector should be allowed a level playing field, so you need predictable policies, industrial policy, agriculture policy, so the investment decisions and economic thinking of the economic actors is guided by the policy framework of the government. And third is the regulation. Wherever you have market failures, you have externalities, you have imperfect competition, like the oligopoly or the monopoly, and utilities are natural monopolies, you need independent regulator. So for that purpose, you need to have these government agencies. But we have a very different situation. We have over-regulation and no regulation at all. You have spurious drugs being supplied to our population. You have adulterated food being supplied to our human beings. But at the same time, you have overbearing regulatory agencies like the Drug and Regulatory Agency, the Food Inspectorate, who are harassing and who are extracting rents. So we have a very different kind of...
Another way to look at it, for example, when I think about it, what you said is very important. We have to begin with the role of the government. And as you said, the role of the government is, okay, some assets government owns and government must know how to utilize them well on behalf of the people. Because after all, a government is only an agent on behalf of the people. Right. So we have national assets, for example, our mountains.
Right.
You know, they are a national asset. Our climate, that's a national asset. The government has to own it, regulate it, etc. Second thing you said is regulation, which is also very important. And third thing you said is policy. Now, when I go back and I look at the origin of the civil service, it was made in the colonial days. Right. They didn't have the responsibility of any of these three things. They had only one responsibility:
collect
to do things for the master.
And law and order.
Exactly. Now the issue is, life has got so much more complicated. We've got, for example, the responsibility of making energy, water, all kinds of things. Regulating markets, as you said, interfacing with the world, all kinds of crazy things. Can the civil service do that job?
But my concept of civil service is not these 1,500 encardered civil servants. My concept of the civil service is the larger civil service where agriculture researchers, educational experts, accountants, economists, engineers, all are part. Out of the 15,000 grade 17 to 22 officers in the federal government, you have 13,500 specialists who have no career progression, no rules as to how they will be governed. They are disaffected. They are demotivated. Instead of doing their best, they are actually so demoralized that they are subtracting value. Because people like me who are encardered have a complete freedom to go from one grade to another automatically without performance. But they are stuck. Now you tell me a PhD in taxonomy, zoology, ecology is sitting in the Agriculture Research Council in grade 17 or 18 for 10 years. And his class fellow, who was much inferior to him in the grades of this, in the college and university, has become the secretary to the government and he's given all the perks and all the privileges, and this guy is rotten. You think he's going to make a contribution?
Very important.
So my concept of civil service is not the colonial civil service, but the enlarged cadre of all the civil servants who are professionals, who are experts in their field. For the 21st century, it is the knowledge economy, and we have to rely on these people.
So, Doctor, what's your finding then? You've written a book recently.
Yeah.
You've written the NCGR.
Yeah.
How has your view evolved? First of all, give us your finding. How has your view evolved?
My view is now what my friend Musharraf Zaidi says is very conservative according to him. And I've learned this. Because my NCGR report has not been implemented by three political governments, so I became more humble.
Yeah.
And I became more modest. And I said, let me identify 24 institutions which are key for four national objectives. Security, growth, equity, and accountability. If we have these as our priorities, which institutions will directly or indirectly contribute to the achievement of these policy objectives. And I've identified 24 such organizations. And I say, okay, don't go for sweeping across the board reforms, but let's start making these institutions strong. And what does it require? The head of the institution should be based on the criteria which are transparent, and his selection or her selection should be based on competence, knowledge, integrity, and performance. And that individual then should be given a security of tenure for 3 years that he cannot be removed from the office without any due process. And he should be given resources in order to perform, and finally, he should be held accountable for results, whether he has achieved the performance indicators which were given to him. What will happen? If you have the right man on the right job, he will bring in, down the line, people who will be performers, because his own neck is on the noose. So I said, please do not politicize these 24 institutions. And my pet example is that of the federal and the provincial public service commissions. Because all the grades 17 to 22 are recruited there, I also want them to be in charge of the promotion policy. So if you have neutral, impartial, competent, honest members and the chairman of the public service commission who will not be influenced by sifarish or by political considerations, they will select the best people into these grades. When you have got the best people, that will have a capillary effect on all the other institutions. So that's a modest example. And I hope that this government, which has no excess baggage, but which has come out with very big commitment to reforms of governance, will try to take up these 24 institutions and restructure and reform them.
What are the other reforms you wanted in the NCGR?
NCGR, we wanted to reduce the number of the ministries and the divisions, reorganize 410 public sector corporations and autonomous bodies into mergers, liquidation, and privatization, simplify the rules of business and the procedures which have been in existence for times immemorial, bring in e-government and put everything on the website, reduce the paperwork, upload all the forms which an ordinary citizen needs in order to get the permissions or the permits and other things. There will be no interaction between the citizen and the government functionary. Everything will be done electronically so that discretionary powers are reduced. Service standards are given So if I have to apply for a driver's license, and I have given the driver's license test, in 7 days, I should be issued that license. Registration of land deed, that's a big scandal. So you have to have, these are the documents you require. You submit these documents, and if there are no hurdles, you should get your land record in 15 days. So those were some of the e-government, business process reengineering, structure of the government, civil service, human resource policies, which has the whole value chain, starting from recruitment.
What about training?
Training is very much part of
so
this
how would
human resource value chain.
Right now? Right now what happens is they come in, they're trained for 2 years, then mid-career they're trained for another 6 months, then another 6 months.
Yeah, but this training is totally inappropriate in relation to either the development of the skill set or the managerial prowess which you need for others. So we have a very efficient training model which is followed by the Pakistan military. For every promotion, you have to go through those. And there is a screening process. So you start as a PMA cadet, 250. Only 3 or 4 end up because the training and performance are used in order to purge out and weed out those who are not up to the mark. In our case, everybody after a certain time gets promoted, whether their training performance or
but
not.
And the army also has portable pensions.
Yeah.
We have a problem that people are waiting for 60.
Yeah.
I know many people in the planning commission, for example, when I was there,
yeah,
who would have died to leave. They wanted to leave,
yeah,
but they were stuck.
I think we have to have a more flexible pension system where people after 20 years or 25 years, if they want to opt out on the pro rata basis, should be able to, you know, go get out. I also have a welfare mechanism that the civil servants are given discretionary land plots when they reach 22, or they're given houses which only accommodate 15% of the population of the civil servants. And this creates discrimination, and people are prepared to put everything in order to get these perks. And I said, we have to get away with it. Let us have a welfare scheme whereby by the time a civil servant, whether he's grade 1 or he's grade 22, retires, he is at least given a plot of land which he can build a house out of the benevolent fund, out of his provident fund, and some of his own contribution, like the Askari housing schemes, where as soon as an army officer retires, he has got something to look at. Here there are people who have got 6 plots, and there are people who don't have 1 plot.
So essentially what you're saying, obviously the music to anybody's ears, you're saying there should be merit, 1.
Yes.
2, there should be good process. And 3, there should be good training. And 4, there should be good emoluments or earnings.
Compensation.
Incentivized.
Yeah.
Now, the number of things need to be detailed here, and I think that's very important. But first, I'd like to stop here and say, I think these are very important subjects for research. And I find it very surprising that Pakistani researchers or academics have not done enough work in this area. I mean, how difficult is it to go out and measure some of these things? And I would, one of the things that I keep saying in my podcast, I hope that the students are listening to this podcast. And I would say to those students that these are eminently sensible subjects to do some research for your BA, PhD, MA thesis and or your publication and try and find out.
You're absolutely right on the spot. And IBA, I started helping, for example, the Sindh government, both in their fiscal policy, but also in other areas. And because we started the master's program, so some of the dissertations were actually focused on those real-world problems. But the difficulty is that our faculty members themselves have gone to the institutions in the West, and when they come back with their PhDs, they want to pursue the same topics and the same field in which they were trained, and they don't want to get out of that particular preoccupation because this is more challenging. Secondly, and I've talked to every chairman of the HEC, we do not place importance on the applied research which will affect the public policy. We are looking for index journals of the international repute where the peers are the only beneficiaries of that paper. The country doesn't, the university doesn't. So I hope I've talked to Tariq Banuri also that we have to change this whole incentive structure for our professors and faculty members. And unless we do that, your complaint, which is totally legitimate, that there is a complete disconnect between our research institutions and our public policy matters, would remain unfettered.
But, Dr. Sir, returning to the subject of process, for example. Now, you've talked about policy and regulation. As I said, in the earlier days, in the civil service days of my father or grandfather, life was simple. You had to do magistracy.
Right.
And you had to maintain a bit of law and order and a bit of, you know, revenue. But now, when it comes to policy, especially if you're going to make energy policy or water policy or some complicated subjects like that, or even international aid policy or something, I think it requires deep research and deep thought.
Yes.
You can't do it on the fly. Yeah. The process that we have right now, the section officer will write a note, it'll go to the joint secretary, it revolves about, I think, 2^4 times or something, 16, 18 times, something like that.
Yeah.
And it comes back and forth, and you seem to have a paper made of these scratches. Does that work, or should
we go
into...
In my report in the NCGR, I have given reference to the Chinese model. Chinese have also these 3 years rotation. So the bureaucrat of the ministry keeps on changing his job from energy to finance to administration. So they are generalists. But each ministry has a research and training institute attached to it in which there are permanent civil servants who are experts in the field. So all the research which is done in order to prepare the summaries or the policy papers are carried out by the institutes. And the secretaries or the joint secretaries try to consult with the other ministries in order to get it forward and weave the views of other stakeholders. So their job is not on substantive, but on the procedural and the process oriented. So I had suggested that we should have this, and I created a model which was the Foreign Trade Policy Institute. But unfortunately, we brought in somebody who was a PhD in trade, but as soon as that individual left, some other bureaucrat came, and this link between the trade policy and the trade institute just completely, you know, was done
away. What you're saying is correct, and I've always felt this need, that perhaps, you know, every, for example, big energy crisis that we have.
Yeah, we should have energy.
Or the tax reform thing, tax problem, for example, the huge revenue problem
that
we got. Every tax reform meeting, I used to ask them, where is your research department?
Right.
They said, we have none.
Yeah.
So they're making proposals on the
fly. Absolutely.
Every time we talked about energy reform, I'd ask NEPRA or the Ministry of Water and Power, where are your researchers?
Yeah.
And they're not. Somehow, our concept is that research is something that you do only for making rockets or space travel.
No,
or something.
Think,
we don't think that research
No, they think the research is something very leisurely, and we don't have the time for that luxury. And also, it is very esoteric, and it is not very relevant to what we are doing. Now, in the State Bank, I was very fortunate that we had very strong research department. So when I would prepare a proposal for the government, it will be underpinned by solid evidence and the arguments and the logic. And today, We have built a capacity in the State Department, in the State Bank, that we have 30 PhDs, all foreign trained, and they are as good as any, you know, Federal Reserve or Bank of England researchers, because they have got their feet on the ground, but they are also helping.
Now, they are getting the salary. You couldn't get the Ministry of Finance of the FBI to do that?
No, because my salary structure of the State Bank is what I proposed in the NCGR.
Yeah.
I stripped off all the lower grade functionaries into a corporation, offered them golden handshake, reduced the size of that, used the savings in order to augment the compensation packages of our younger people who were coming from abroad or who we were recruiting on a comparative basis. So today, I have been away now for 13 years. LUMS and IBA graduates are applying for the comparative examination of the State Bank because the initial salary structure is comparable to that of the multinational corporation. So you are able to attract. The grade 21 officer in the State Bank gets six times more than his equivalent in the Ministry of Finance.
Good point.
So, but the promotion policy there is highly comparative. You cannot get promoted just by seniority. You have to compete with outsiders also.
So here you'll break the seniority process.
Yes.
Because right now you're guaranteed secretary at 826.
No, I am against the seniority basis. And I've practiced it, both in IBA and State
Bank. Doctor, there's another fundamental problem. I appreciate what you're saying on the process. There are two more fundamental problems that I'd like to take up. One is the process of merit. We introduce merit everywhere, and I'm very disappointed to say that somehow it doesn't work. I mean, for example, case in point being the way we hire vice chancellors, right? We've talked about merit, but then what we do is we put out ads that are so tailored to one person or one group, and then we have so-called search committee, which is not a search committee, which is an interview committee. And that committee interviews candidates for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and they make a proposal. I mean, how do we get this going? How do we get good?
Now, let me give you my own experience. I am member of the KP selection committee with Sohail Naqvi and Dr. Atar Rahman. We have to abide by the law which establishes the criteria for the vice chancellor. So the advertisement has to be done by that. But we have refined the process by advertising not only in Pakistan, but outside Pakistan also. So we were able to get some very good candidates who are of Pakistani origin who applied for the vice chancellorships. And then we designed a eligibility criteria that academic achievements, research, publications, administrative experience. And the short list was based on the combined marks given by each member, and those shortlisted through this process were brought in for interview. And some of them who had done very well in these criteria, we found were totally ineffective to carry out the responsibility of the vice chancellor. So I think the composition of the selection committee and the process through which you identify the candidates. And no human endeavor, you will agree with me, is 100% foolproof, right? But at least if nine vice chancellors we selected, and eight of them were considered by the general public to be acceptable, I think we are okay. So the selection committee composition, the process of the selection committee, some of the politicians complained to Imran Khan that these vice chancellors are all from ANP and MMA and PMLN. They don't belong to the PTI. And he said, that's why I appointed the selection committee, because they don't know what the political affiliation of this is. And that's why we got the support and we were able to do it. But your point generally is valid, that if you tilt the selection committee in a certain way to get your favorites, and you tailor make the advertisement in order to get your favorites, the whole process becomes totally perfunctory. So I would not go against the selection process on merit, but I would pay more attention to the selection committee's composition as to who are the people, and also on the advertisement itself. So we have to refine that. And in this regard, I think the tussle between the provincial HEC and the federal HEC has proved to be a big, big inhibitor in improving this. Because the federal HEC still wants to retain the complete, open, transparent process. But the provincial HEC, under the influence of the Higher Education Department of the provinces, wants to tailor it in a way that their favorites can come in. So I think we have...
See, even in the public sector enterprises, for example, EIAB being case in point. I mean, we have seen again and again the process being rigged to bring in people. The other thing that really I find very surprising is that when I look at England or the US or whatever, some of their best people, especially the academics, are on boards. And they're doing a good job on the boards. Here in Pakistan, we are very averse to having academics.
Now they've started. I mean, I saw some of the professors being taken on the boards, which is a beginning, which is a very good beginning. Some women are also being taken up. So I think your message is getting some traction. And I think over time it will be. But we should keep on educating these issues. We should not remain complacent. My idea is that even if my views and my proposals are not getting anywhere, I should keep the pressure on. And I think that's what you should do, and others of us who feel in the larger interest of the country, that we don't have monopoly of wisdom, but at least we can start the dialogue going as to what is the direction.
Ultimately, Dr. Sir, two things matter. One is ideas matter.
Yeah.
Two is that everything is evolutionary.
Evolutionary.
I mean, you set in process something that will work. Another point that I want to raise with you, which is very important also, is you raised this thing about different grades and different skills, for example. For example, you talked about agriculturists. Recently, I got very involved in town planning. So I got hold of some town planners and did a podcast with them. And it is very interesting that those town planners were feeling very, very disenfranchised. They study town planning. They have a specialization in town planning. Some of them have been overseas, some of them whatever. And their career horizon is from grade 17 to 19.
That's what I was saying. That's what I was telling you about agriculture scientists as an example. Same applies to every
doctors. Doctors retire in grade 20, right? So now this hierarchy that we've created, hierarchy of professions, isn't this inimical to growth?
But this is what I have proposed in the National Executive Service and the Provincial Executive Service. It will be open to all civil servants in those grades from 19 to 22, they will compete. And on the basis of the competition, they will be
assigned.
What about
outside competition?
I will also introduce that also.
Okay.
Like I did in the State Bank, the same model I have proposed NCGR, that for every position, you will be outsiders and insiders.
Okay.
But insiders today are at a complete disadvantage because they have no future known to them as to what is going to happen to them. We are paying them, but they're not serving us. And they're...
But, Doctor, what are you going to do about this? Think about it. And a young kid, even your State Bank, for example, there are a couple of people here in the fund, right? Very good kids. They joined the fund. Why? Because the fund pays them so much better.
Yeah, that will happen.
Now, but I mean, think about it another way. In Latin America, in most places, Singapore, for example, they made it such that their jobs are more attractive. Is that something we can do? What can we offer good people? Because I remember when I was looking for the Planning Commission chief economist, no economist worth his salt was willing to take that job for two reasons. One, the salary, and two, the fact that, you know, he would get no dignity. Yeah. India at least has done this for Arvind Subramaniam or with Kaushik Basu or with Ajay Chebra. They've made that job so attractive that people want to take that job just for the international exposure.
No, you're right. I mean, You came to the Planning Commission from IMF. Mm-hmm. Hafiz came from the World mm-hmm. Bank. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a mm-hmm. tendency among ours. My own view is that serving in these international institutions mm-hmm. is a plus point
yeah.
for anyone who assumes
yeah.
positions in Pakistan. And India has been doing that, and we should continue to do that. So I have no problem if my director of the Foreign Exchange Department comes to IMF.
Right.
I can ask him after a while to come and take up some position in the State Bank as deputy governor or governor.
How can we attract him? That's key.
I think...
should our salary structures be revised for that?
They should be, yeah. Mm. We should have higher salary structures mm. for certain positions, and that's what my recommendation for these 24 institutions are.
Mm.
They should not be paid the BPS 22 mm. and 21 grades. Mm. They should be given higher salaries mm. according to. The problem right now, which I notice, mm. is our judiciary.
Mm.
Our judiciary mm. is saying all these people who are being paid salaries higher than the chief secretary of a province mm. are doing a great deed of mischief. If you have that mindset, then God help us. Then we are not going to get the best talent for this country. We should always look at the cost and the benefit. If you are giving somebody about 10 lakhs of rupees as a specialist in liver and kidney transplant, and that individual is able to stop 50 people yeah. from going abroad,
yeah.
you are saving huge foreign exchange for the country.
Mm.
But we have one mm. single obsession, which is cost.
Mm.
We never look at the benefits of this.
Very good.
And I think the judiciary mm. will be well advised to look both at the cost mm. as well as the benefit of
it. Also, let me also tell you, I've talked to a number of judges, and I tried to do that when I was in the Planning Commission, said judiciary should at least have some economics teaching in the, in the Judicial Academy.
Yeah.
And they resisted. They said right. they don't. But let me ask you a couple of other more questions which are very important. One is, Dr. if we are going to hire good people, currently the way we pay is basically salary, lots of tax-free perks, right, including plots, housing, board memberships, foreign trips, mm. etc. Currently, the way I look at it is they're driven by those perks rather than
right.
the salary.
Yeah.
And the civil servants are always cash poor. When it yeah. comes to marrying their daughter yeah. or sending their son yeah. to Harvard, they have to worry about how
correct.
They're going to do it. And
correct.
That, in a sense, is an incentive for them to cheat. Should we think of monetizing the perks, for example?
But you and I mm. did that.
Mm-hmm.
You remember mm-hmm. that in the Paid Pension
Commission
yeah. Yeah. we did the experiment with abolishing the transport mm. perks.
Mm.
But you know, it is
Effect.
The mm. niyat, mm. which I call the niyat mm. of the beneficiaries. They are getting 95,000 rupees in lieu of the transport, but the number of cars in the ministries
mm. has increased.
Yeah. And the petrol mm. expenditure and the repair expenditure hasn't gone up.
But Dr. Sahib, I did another...
That is because of the lack of centralized monitoring.
Because.
If I was there, I would say mm. there will be a part of the commission mm. which will be monitoring mm. the use of the public transport
absolutely.
And taking action against those who are violating this.
Absolutely.
But if there is no enforcement
yeah.
and there is no penalty,
mm.
the human nature says, let
That's
us
right.
take the benefit.
That's absolutely
so. But the principle which you and I agree
mm.
that the perks are the last thing we should give
mm.
to the individuals
mm.
because
mm.
every family has a different requirements.
Mm.
Some are sending their children to higher education.
Mm.
They want more cash.
Mm.
They can live in a smaller house.
Mm.
And they can afford a car or Volkswagen or
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
Others want to live in a big house because they have a large extended family.
Mm-hmm.
Let them choose it. We should not decide
exactly.
what it should be.
Exactly, exactly. The other thing, Dr. Sahib, which is very important is behavioral economics tells us two or three things, which is very interesting to think about. They're coming out again and again with this, that what motivates people. So the simple economics thing that I learned in class was, hey, it's only money.
Mm.
But now they're saying it's not just money.
Not money.
It's three things. It's money, and it's some kind of honor, some kind of
dignity,
you know, your recognition. Yes. Third thing is the autonomy to be able to do something creative, something, you know, you don't want to be a file pusher, you want to be a creative person, you want to do something, right? Do we offer these three things to our
people? No, we don't. We don't offer any one of these three things. Mm-hmm. And the whole purpose of the reform is that you give autonomy to the individual and the organization to come up to your expectations. Mm-hmm. And if there is a deviation, you should have both reward and the penalty. Mm-hmm. If they have overperformed, you reward them. If you have underperformed, then you penalize them. Mm-hmm. And the dignity will come when judiciary, NAB, FIA, and the media start making a distinction between an honest civil servant who is making a judgment call, which may be a wrong judgment, in the larger interest, and a person who is doing this in order for himself to benefit from that judgment. Till we make this distinction and we sweep every civil servant with the same stick, I think this dignity and honor will never come in. And that, I think, is...
Basically, what you're saying is punish malfeasance, not an honest mistake.
Right?
Simple. Yeah. Agree. Now, this is absolutely well said and absolutely well taken. Look at the colonial civil service, for example. If I go back and I look at it, it's quite interesting, even though they had a limited mandate. But the autonomy and honor did two or three things. One, and secondly, the research. The district gazetteers still remain a huge source of information, right? PhD dissertation.
Right, absolutely.
And I remember, you might remember, Dr. Saab, there was a guy who came from a university here called Ralph Prebanti. He did a book on the research in the bureaucracy of Pakistan. Today, I'm surprised bureaucrats think that research is not their function. Used to be their function, right?
Right.
I mean, they used to be writers, they used to be thinkers, they used to be researchers. We don't have that. So those two points are very well taken. I think those are very important things to bit. Now, Dr. Saab, transitionally, I think no government will be able to take the risk of changing the system, right? And one of the principal stumbling blocks there is the rules of business that you mentioned that we didn't discuss. The rules of business make the secretary the principal accounting officer. So if I think about it, would I be wrong if I said that the whole government is run by five secretaries?
Yeah.
If you take the PSPM, Secretary of Finance, Establishment, Cabinet, I don't think anybody else was involved. The rest are all secondary, right? PIA reports to so and so. Every agency is linked by the rules of business. So what about the rules of business?
No, they have to be changed. But there are two...
all autonomous agencies report to the secretary.
There are two variants to this. One is de jure and the other de facto. If you look at the rules of business, the PSPM derives his power... because all the ministers send every summary to the Prime Minister. Now, I have great regard for Shahid Khaqan Abbasi, who said, I don't have to read every summary. You take the decisions, and you are responsible for that. Where you think that my intervention is required, only those... The PSPM during Shahid Khaqan Abbasi was not very strong. So I can give you the example of the de jure and the de facto. The second is that our Ministry of Finance, because the country has remained in the crisis mode, therefore assumes disproportionate powers in the plea that, look, everything has to be curtailed and everything has to be controlled and the financial resources do not permit us. So the powers which have been derived by these five people are not an intrinsic part of the rules of business, but because of the nature. But I have argued in my report that we have to revise the rules of business and make them congruent with the present realities, because the 60s and the 70s realities have changed. So you have a very valid point, and that's why I keep emphasizing that if you have an e-government where everything is in control, transparent, you don't need so many rules in force. Foreign Exchange Department of the State Bank was abolished by putting the Foreign Exchange Manual on the website. So you go to your bank and you know that if you send your child for higher education, this is your entitlement. The bank looks at the same manual and says, this is your entitlement. So the whole department which used to give the approval, it disappears. You can model that in the government also. And the rules will be automatically either eliminated or they will no longer continue to be a hindrance, which they are.
Dr. Sir, isn't it a shame that the army has developed e-government and
yes,
we haven't?
We haven't.
I mean, isn't
yeah.
that amazing that the civilian side still has those fee tewali fire with the nalas opening them? I mean, this is crazy. Whereas the army has iPads and, you know.
I think this is why I'm saying that we should not blame, which is the case in Pakistan, the army, because they have modernized themselves. They take mediocres or at intermediate level and turn them into first-rate human resource. And we take the best and the brightest and turn them into cynics after 10 years.
Very well put. Very
that
well
is
put.
What I consider.
Excellent. Dr. Saab, thank you very much. But before we go, let me ask you two questions which I ask all my guests. One is very important. What is your advice to students who are doing their PhDs, MAs, etc.? I think you said something very important, that look around you, fix your own problems. Rather. But other than that, what advice would you give them, especially in this area?
I think the world is becoming highly competitive. So whatever you are doing, whether you're doing science or you're doing math or you're doing humanities and social sciences, try to excel and try to gain the mastery of that subject rather than go for shortcut that we can memorize this portion because it will appear in the examination. Because knowledge is going to make the difference in your career. And the degrees are just a piece of paper. So what you acquire, what you assimilate, and what you apply is going to determine what your future career is going to be. That is my advice to the students. Secondly, when you have mastered the subject, you must look at the problems Pakistan is facing, whether it is agriculture or energy or scientific development. Use that knowledge in order to apply that to solving the problems of this country. Because we cannot afford to have basic research. Basic research can be done elsewhere, but applied research is what we should do and try to encourage our students to do that.
Thank you. My last question. Recommend a book, a movie, whatever you think that has influenced you the most, that you think every young man should read or see or think about.
I think there are many books. But my favorite book is, because of my very much inkling towards globalization and capitalism, is by Danny Roderick. His book on the limitations of globalization is something I would very much recommend. It has changed my own views. That capitalism in its unfettered and unadulterated form is not what we should be experimenting in developing countries. The balance between the state and the marketplace is something which we have to think about very carefully. Even, I think, your seniors at Chicago are beginning to think
reconsider
this philosophy.
Oh, absolutely.
And your son has written quite a bit on
he's
this. He is challenging your own views.
Right.
And I think that is breath of fresh air.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Saab. This has been wonderful. We shall do this again at some point. Thank you.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai. Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.